Hello and welcome to the Waterstones podcast once again. I'm Will Rycroft and today I will be speaking to four authors who all found inspiration from roughly the same period of history and yet have used that inspiration to create four very, very distinct novels. We will be chatting about why the past still has something to tell us about our present, the appeal of writing historical fiction, and the challenges of handling research, real people, and wrangling all of those things together into a novel. Susan Stokes Chapman grew up in the Georgian city of Lichfield in Staffordshire, which might have something to do with her interest in this particular period. Her debut novel, Pandora, combines intrigue in the world of antiquities with another current cultural fascination, which is the allure of Greek myth. So first of all, welcome, Susan.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me, Will.
Jill Hornby has taken inspiration from a real-life literary mystery in the past, the destruction by Cassandra Austin of the letters from her sister, Jane, to create the Sunday Times bestseller Miss Austin in 2020. Her latest novel, Godmersham Park, sees her return to the life of the famous novelist, this time looking at her friendship with a young governess. Welcome, Jill.
Lovely to be here.
Now, of course, one of the most famous opening lines in literature tells us what a man in possession of a good fortune must be in want of. And Sophie Irwin's debut novel, A Lady's Guide to Fortune Hunting, has taken that spirit and run with it, adding the kind of wit and wiles that have made Bridgerton such a success on TV. Welcome, Sophie.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited.
And to round off our cast, Karen Joy Fowler, no stranger to Austin herself as the author of the novel The Jane Austen Book Club, but who in her latest book, Booth, has taken us across the Atlantic to 19th century America to tell the tale of the ill-fated Booth family, where Shakespearean tragedy combines with family drama and the meeting that we all know is coming between President Lincoln and John Wilkes Booth. Welcome, Karen.
Thank you so much.
There are so many things that we could use as our jumping off point here, because your books are so rich and detailed. But I think we should start with the period. All of these books, they sort of take place or roughly begin at the very beginning of the 19th century. Karen's takes the action a little bit deeper into that century. But I wondered what it was about that time period that is so alluring. And I'm going to come to you first of all, Susan, because as I said in the intro, you grew up in a Georgian town. What is it about that period that appeals to you so much?
Well, I'm going to give a very cliche answer here and actually say that I came from a family that grew up on the BBC Sunday period dramas. And it's such a shame that they don't do that so much anymore. But I always was immersed, I suppose, in historical televised pieces, historical fiction, but it was actually the 1995 adaptation of Pride and Prejudice that really did it for me. And it had nothing to do with Mr. Darcy in a wet shirt, nothing to do with that. But for me, it was very much the romance and the elegance and the beauty of it. Now, at the time, I was 10 years old and I didn't really understand that there was a lot. There's a lot of other things going on in that period. There was a much darker element to it, but it was Austen's Pride and Prejudice that actually made me read 18th century fiction or fiction set in the 18th century. And it really wasn't until I was starting to read that that I realised, I suppose, that I was living in a city that was just completely perfect to really enrich my passion for the period, I suppose. It was just all part and parcel. 10 years old, and then I think I was 14 when I wanted to be I decided I wanted to be a writer. And I think it was just all these, a little domino effect all just kind of came tumbling around from that. It's a fascinating period, and it's such a long period of time as well. It's 1714 all the way up until the 1830s. That's a really chunky period of history that anybody can dig their teeth into. So many stories to tell. I think it's just a treasure trove.
Pride and Prejudice has been mentioned there, Sophie, so I'm going to come to you next, as I mentioned that opening line in the intro. What is it about this period that appeals to you so much? Because I know it's something that you have done a lot of research around.
Oh, God, where to start? I mean, I think I was also, I would say, deeply inspired by Colin Firth and Pride and Prejudice, which is also so funny because thinking back to how much of a moment that was for us all watching that compared to sort of how chaste it was and compared to sort of Bridgerton now kind of makes me laugh that we've sort of how fast we've grown in that way. Yes, Austen was a massive driving force behind my interest in the period, definitely. Although I got into the Regency and the Georgian period in general because of Georgia Heyer more than Austen. Mm. So it's actually Heyer got me into Austen rather than the other way around, even though their influence runs in the reverse in real life. My granddad actually was a huge Georgia Heyer fan, and when he died, I inherited a big stack of his books. And she's sort of like think of her as Austen's granddaughter in spirit. And it was just the best escapism I'd ever really read. So that's why then I went back and discovered all sorts else that I loved about the Georgian period.
And Jill, I mentioned the real life sort of happenings that have inspired some of your writing, but we'll come to that a little bit later. But I wonder what it is maybe about the period that you find so enticing to write about.
Well, it is very much Jane Austen's presence in the period, but it's also the fact that it was such an intellectually curious and alive mm-hmm. period in Britain. It was the place, London was packed full of geniuses, and there was so much sort of philosophical development and social and intellectual and cultural and artistic development. And yet the role of women didn't budge one inch. So here are all these women who can read anything. They didn't have the restrictions of the Victorian girl. Jane could just wade through her dad's library, which was full of all sorts of, you know, publications. And there was no censorship as there would have been for a Victorian young girl. So she could read anything. There was Mary Wollstonecraft. There were all of these extraordinary women sort of doing amazing things. And yet they were a woman like Jane. I'm cleverer than the rest of them, in fact, it turned out, and so restricted in what she could do. And that juxtaposition seems to me, I mean, when you think about them, I don't think you need Gloria Steinem to define feminism for you in order to kind of think those sort of thoughts, to look around you and think, hang on, I'm cleverer than him. And I was born first, and yet here I am stuck here sewing while they go off to their extraordinary fortunes. Mm-hmm. So that intrigues me, how they dealt with that sort of frustration.
Mm. We are absolutely going to talk about particularly the position of women in this period of history and those restrictions that you mentioned. Before we get to that, Karen, we're talking here about sort of Georgian or Regency period. And of course, those terms are not maybe translating so well across the Atlantic, different terminology over there, but you're writing in the same sort of period of history, but a completely different culture. So what was it for you that makes this period so fascinating to write about?
First of all, I think that it's not, in fact, the period I am most drawn to, although it is the period in this book. I'm more drawn to a bit later, like kind of 1890s sort of Gilded Age period, and particularly the science of that period. But my answer in terms of Booth is, I'm afraid, a very American answer, which is that we see the country as having sort of two founding moments, the first one being the Revolutionary War, where we left all of you to your own devices, and then the period of the Civil War, which is sort of the second founding. And so my book is very much about the Civil War and about the impact of that, and about the continuing, enduring impact of that on American politics. One of the major issues, I think, now in my country is who gets to decide what our history is, who's going to tell the story of what our history is, because, you know, we are currently looking at a situation where there are laws in several states essentially making it illegal to teach American children the actual history, because it will make them too sad to learn what we actually did. And in this climate, trying to write a true narrative is a necessary act of activism, I think.
This is an interesting thing, isn't it? So the question of why write historical fiction and what can historical fiction teach us about the world that we live in today? Because sometimes it can feel like a great piece of escapism. But as you're saying there, for you, it's you see it very much as a piece of modern day activism. Do you hope that it will read that way and that people will use novels as tools to effect change?
I think that would be such a wonderful thing to believe. I think it's very hard to point to examples where a novel has actually turned the con. It's not that there are no examples, but there are few examples. And as we have sorted ourselves into our political silos, I think, the people who might have their opinions changed by a novel are probably not reading that novel, is my guess. I would love it if I was wrong.
Let's talk about the position of women in society, because your four novels are very, very different to each other in tone and approach and structure. And yet they all have female characters who are absolutely being held back by the society in which they live. And as you were saying, Jill, in many cases, definitely the smartest person in the room. And therefore, it's incredibly frustrating to see them so held back. Is that part of the appeal for you as female novelists to write these stories? Because you get to, I guess, write that wrong or to give them an opportunity to display their strengths. Susan, I'll come to you first, if that's okay.
Yeah, I actually think that's a very fair point to say that I suppose we are trying to challenge the issue where in so many ways the man is the person that has the power in reality and in fiction for many, many years. And I think as female writers and using women as our main characters, I think it is our mission, I suppose, to try and show that other side, to give these women some agency. And it's not that they weren't strong before, but that we don't always see that strength. And it's something that I think is extremely important and something that I think many of us have been trying to do for many, many years. I mean, Jill mentioned Mary Wollstonecraft earlier on. She was a woman who was determined to write her opinion, to let everybody know that she was perfectly capable of being such a strong, independent woman. And so I just think for this period in particular, it is very, very important to show that these women weren't always just sitting there doing their sewing. They were strong women. They had careers. They had the passion and the verve to actually get ahead. And certainly with my character, Dora, she is an aspiring jewellery designer. I did a lot of research for Georgian jewellery, and I couldn't actually find any record of any woman designing jewellery. That doesn't necessarily mean, though, that they weren't there and they weren't doing these things. And I just wanted to address that, I suppose. I wanted to give my female character a career. I wanted to give her the opportunity to show that women were perfectly capable of having a profession. Even though society wouldn't necessarily have allowed it, so to speak. I just wanted to give my female character agency, and I think we're potentially going to touch on this later as well, but also give the mythological Pandora agency as well. But I think that's a slightly different topic, which I think we're going to touch on later. It's very important at the end of the day. That's what I mean. Yeah.
Sophie, I'll come to you now because I mentioned Bridgerton when I was introducing your book, and it would be very easy, I suppose, to think of your book as, oh, it's just sort of a nice piece of entertainment and that sort of mold. But it does absolutely have this very strong sense of injustice that runs through it, that these women are constantly having to play by men's rules, even when the rules seem absurd. How do you sort of balance, I suppose, the humour and the lighter side of your writing together with that very important undercurrent?
Oh, great question. And it's a constant challenge. I think it's helped slightly because the sort of genre of Regency romance amongst historical fiction is one that's demarcated more specifically for pleasure and escapism. So you sort of have, in a way, permission to look at the lighter, frothier end of historical fiction, which for me was sort of a help and a hindrance, because part of it is it means that you don't necessarily have to worry about capturing the broad scope of exactly what it was like to live in this time, because it's more of a the reader wants to read about the frothy ball and, you know, someone wrapping someone with a fan, and they don't necessarily want from my book the grittier and like the more nuanced side. So that in a way there's sort of a permission to go light, which is quite freeing. And at the same time, which you very kindly said, sort of I in my book also wanted to explore more of the nuance around that and more of the sort of a sense of injustice about how limited, as we've sort of been discussing, how limited choices were for women at this time and how you would sort of move through the cracks of what you were allowed to do in order to get what you wanted. And partly the injustice I found narratively speaking, I think I had quite a lot of anger writing it, where I was like, right, and she's going to do this. And then you do a bit of research, you're like, no, she's not. Okay. So then it's like, then she's going to do this. Okay, she can't do that either. Right. Okay. I guess she's at a ball and she's dancing again. So I felt a lot of personal anger trying to find out what she could possibly do in writing the book that wouldn't have been, had her thrown out in disgrace.
Jill, when I spoke to Hilary Mantel about her Wolf Hall trilogy, she said that one of the joys of writing those books, or the reason, I suppose, that she wanted to write that story was because there were these gaps in the historical record, this sort of blank space which she could then fill with her narrative. And it seems to me that you similarly have found these little tidbits of kind of literary mystery that leave you with this wonderful blank space to fill with your stories. That presumably is irresistible for you as a writer.
Well, it's very easy to find a blank space in history wherever a woman was previously occupied. Because no records are kept, nobody took any notice of them, and they weren't constantly, you know, drafting their memoir for the good of posterity. So, yes, find me a woman and I'll find you a mystery. What I wanted to do was, you know, the normal fabulous novels of this time are all with women aiming for marriage, which Jane herself does. But the thing that really hit me in the face when I was at the beginning of researching Miss Austen was that only 30% of women got married in this time. There was a war on, there weren't many men. It was partly because in the sort of lower classes there were more common law arrangements rather than going to church and signing a register. But also, was marriage so great? If you married an almost perfect stranger, you hadn't been alone with him in a room before the wedding night, your father would have settled money on you, it would have gone straight to your husband, he could have put it on a roulette wheel or done what he liked with it, you'd never see it again. You bagged somebody when you were 18, which was really fantastic, great thing to do. Remember, Anne Elliot is on the shelf at 28. So you get somebody at 18, you're in for 20 pregnancies. You're not going to survive them all. It was a mortal condition being married in those days. And so everybody had always pitted Jane, as they pitted Anne Sharp, for being spinsters. And they pitted Cassandra because she never made it to the altar. But actually, isn't it a bit of a result? Anne Sharp, the governess in Godmersham Park, develops a career. Now, there was only one possible career, really, which was teaching. But she did it, and she got it, and she went on to run a boarding school in Liverpool for many years. Jane developed her career on the quiet of being a writer. But she and Cassandra and their best friend Martha and their mum got to live in a cottage together while Jane wrote, and there wasn't a man stomping about the place. They didn't have to listen to his opinions. They didn't have to have supper if they didn't want to. They were living off their own pittance. That seems to me, in Georgian England, to be something of a result for an intelligent woman. And I will not have them pitted for being in this, what historians now call a spinster cluster, women gathered in under a cottage. You know, you just think, well,
spinster cluster, that is the most...
Jill, you said like 20 things I want to write down.
I don't think I've ever had an episode where there has been such synchronised nodding of all participants.
Well, I am a woman who would not have survived my first childbirth had I been born 100 or 150 years ago. So I am very conscious of this issue when I read. You know, I love Regency romances. I am completely swept away, except that I am always thinking, don't marry him. You will die. You will die. I don't care how charming and good looking he is. Run for your life.
I mean, if you had a completely passionless marriage, you might make it through to 60. But if you happen to get on with your husband, then you were for it, frankly. Out of all of Jane's sisters-in-law, only one survived. The rest lost. They were gone on their 8th, their 9th, their 11th children. They were gone. Then you've got a house full of motherless children. I mean...
Yeah, have a dance and be done with it.
This is why Jane never took her heroines beyond the altar. Because who knew what they'd find?
Something in Jane's letters that there's a real sense of whenever there's like a pregnant woman in the family or everything, they're all a little bit, you can feel the slight like tension in those passages, which is always...
Well, quite rightly, because they did all go like that. No, they were on their knees in the last month. And it wasn't just dying in childbirth and the motherless baby. It was, you know, the injuries you sustained in those days, which are still sustained today, but then you go to the doctor and it's sorted out. You were on the sofa for the rest of your life, knocking back the laudanum. You know, hardly able to walk. It's a terrible condition.
As limited as the choices were, if you go and look at the actual women, they were availing themselves of adventures and possibilities that don't seem to fit into the narrow choices that were given to them. So it's not, you know, it's not that we're creating a world in which women do things women did not do. We are actually, I think, celebrating the women who found a way through despite what was... despite what they were told their limitations were.
Because if you hadn't married by the age of 26, from then on you were living on your wits. You know, your brother might be keeping you for a bit, but then he might go off you. And they had to find their way through. They had to improvise. And Jane and Cassandra had to do that all the time, sort of swerving their way through in order to make it. But a lot of them made it, you know. And they lived longer than the married ones.
Of course, one of the elements that's holding women back in this period is money. They don't have their own money. They don't have property. They are at the whim of the men, as you said. And obviously, we have moved on. But it seems to me that money is still an issue for women if we're still having the conversation about the fact that there is not equal pay in the workplace. And still those sort of issues. Is that one of the reasons why novels like this will continue to resonate in a way which isn't just sort of simply looking back and going, oh, how awful it was then, but actually how much have things changed today?
Sorry for butting in. I was just going to say, I think that is possibly why so many of our novels have such an appeal for a female readership, because there is something that we all recognise within our characters and the lives that they are living.
I was going to say, this, obviously, with just as much in America as in England at that time, the women don't have the property, they don't have the jobs. The eldest daughter, Rosalie, in your book, is almost immediately condemned to this life of spinsterhood. It's just never expected that she'll ever leave the house. And that's her role, that it's just sort of set from so early in her life, which is, I found so frustrating as a reader. I wanted her to be able to do so much more with her life. But it is that sort of money thing. And we were talking, obviously, before the recording started about some of the really tumultuous things that are happening in America at the moment with women. Does that add more fire to your belly when it comes to writing about these kinds of things?
I guess I would start by saying that because I am an older woman, a much older woman, it has been distressing to see that certain things that I thought were settled are not settled. Certain advances that I thought, well, you know, okay, we've done that, now we move forward to the next one. No, you know, instead, that one's going to be taken away and we're going to move backwards. Mm-hmm. You know, this is just, I think that in a very naive way, I am coming face to face with the fact that being a woman is still an issue in a way that I very naively thought that it wasn't anymore. I mean, certainly it's not that being a woman has never ceased to be an issue, but some of the more visible ways in which it has hobbled us. I mean, you know, I think there was a lot of talk after Hillary lost the election about what a role model she was to young girls and what young girls had learned from her candidacy. And I thought what young girls learned from her candidacy is the most qualified and intelligent woman cannot be the stupidest, least qualified man in the world. This is not the message I wanted our daughters to receive. But it's only been reinforced.
Can I just say, I think it's quite interesting time to revisit 19th century, contemporary written 19th century fiction, because we've always read it in the past from a point of progress. And now we're not reading it from a point of progress. It feels, in some ways, that we're going back to meet them, you know.
That's true in America. Do you feel that as well?
Yes, because we have an Atlantic outlook here, you know, and just looking at what's going on over there, I feel, you know, when I was little, you read about Slinkies and they only had them in America and then finally they came to Britain. And I feel rather like that with what's going on in America. But well, like the Slinky, it's coming for us.
What are you complaining about?
I do think that's really interesting, though. As you say, we presume that progress is inexorable, that we don't run back. And what has been, I think, the most terrifying aspect of the Roe v. Wade being overturned in the States was that something like that could be taken away immediately, that it just disappears, like it never happened. And I know, obviously, we've had in recent years the popularity of The Handmaid's Tale as a piece of fiction because of the TV series, and then obviously the parallels that were drawn with Trump's presidency. But it always felt as though there was still sufficient distance between those things that it wasn't quite being shelved in the non-fiction section just yet. But I'm not sure it feels quite so safe anymore, those things. And that, I suppose, adds an urgency to these books that I hadn't even thought of a few weeks ago, because, of course, it only happened a few weeks ago.
Yes. I think, you know, one of the Handmaid's Tale aspects that people are only starting to understand is the way women are going to be hunted, you know, the way their data is going to be used in court, you know, the sort of privacy of the health data, the incredible bounty system that Texas has set up, where any private citizen can sue any woman who, it's just, words fail me.
I will try and steer us into different waters.
Happier waters, yes.
Susan, I want to come to you because, as I mentioned earlier, your book combines the Georgian period that we're talking about with this connection to Greek myth, which is another hugely popular thing at the moment. The retellings of Greek myths continue to find readers. The appeal is quite clear to me, but I wondered why you wanted to bring that into your Georgian story and what it is about the story of Pandora that was particularly important.
I think to address the resonance of Greek myth, first of all, I think for so many of us, Greek myths appeal simply because they are all stories of human nature. They're tragedies, they're love stories, there's horror, but that there's hope there as well. And these are stories that can be recycled and repurposed again and again and again. And we recognise so many of these stories, or at least the echoes of these stories within our daily lives. And I think that is generally why they are so appealing. However, we also know that there are many stories that are, like, at the moment they're being told from a female point of view for the simple reason that, well, as a general rule, I think many Greek myths, they're quite misogynistic in the sense that they've been told from a male point of view, that the version of a woman in these Greek myths are often described by a man. And the appeal there for a female readership at the moment, and why so many novels such as Jennifer Saint's Ariadne, and then Madeline Miller's Circe, and Natalie Haynes' upcoming story Stone Blind, which is about Medusa, we are basically wanting to see it from another point of view. We're wanting to see these stories from a fresh perspective, from the female perspective. I basically wanted to make Pandora a strong person. I wanted her curiosity to be something that could actually release her and give her strength and give her purpose, to give her that agency. And by transplanting Pandora into my character Dora Blake, that's essentially what I was trying to do. So Dora, my novel Pandora is less a retelling of the Greek myth Pandora's box, it's more of a reinterpretation. But by transplanting this woman into the 18th century, I was able to give her a little bit more agency. It was just a really kind of fun thing to do. And everybody obviously knows the Greek myth Pandora's box, but I just felt it would be fun. I just thought it would be a kind of good mix. And it was actually surprisingly easy to do, because I'm asked quite a few times, well, why Greek myth in the 18th century? And I'm not going to go off on a complete tangent, but the general answer is that the Georgians completely were fascinated by the ancient world. If you look at their architecture, if you look at their fashions, and, you know, their jewellery as well, and, of course, the antiquity scene. So Pompeii was excavated in the 1790s, so it was quite a recent thing that had happened, where my novel is set in 1799. And Antiquities, William Hamilton, he's a real character in the novel as well. And he had a complete obsession with collecting Greek vases. And you kind of connect the dots. I'm kind of running away with myself here. But the point is, it was something that was possible to link. And it was, I enjoyed doing it.
Jill, I wanted to come to you because writing the character of Jane Austen into a novel, I can see the appeal for lots of writers, but I can also see that a lot of writers would be scared of taking that on because she's such a beloved author. Were you ever worried about writing her into your books? And how did you make sure that you, I guess, that thing of not wanting to be too reverential to somebody, but also to sort of make sure that you do them justice? Tell me a bit about that process.
Well, I was absolutely terrified. And I mean, what I really wanted to do with Miss Austen was write the case for Cassandra. And I think I'd started it before I realised that this did actually mean that Jane would have to walk and talk and live and do things. I think I was very liberated by the fact that I hadn't signed a contract for this. I was writing it completely on spec. And I mean, I kept coming to the point where Jane had to come in, and I'd delay it and then just write some more Cassandra, and then I'd walk the dog. And then when I wrote Jane, I just kind of deleted it and ran away and then came back again. But then I thought, oh, for heaven's sake, nobody's ever going to read this book. It'll just end up in a drawer, you know, because I'll finish it and show it to somebody and they'll say, well, that's embarrassing. So that was very liberating. And then I was able to just do it, and then was utterly amazed that I got away with it. In a way, I was very helped by Cassandra, because she's destroyed so much. She's created this historical figure, which I think has an awful lot to do with her enduring popularity, which is that we don't really know that much about her. And if we knew more, we might not love her as much. And so she's a bit like God. She can be whatever anybody wants her to be. So people think she's Lizzie Bennet, which she wasn't at all in any way, but they can just present their wishes upon this empty space.
Karen, I'll come to you actually, because whilst we're talking about incorporating real characters into fiction, I was an actor for 20 years and consider myself to be somebody who knows a bit about theatre, having lived there for so long, but hadn't really made the connection that the Booth family was this Shakespearean tour de force in America, that they had this theatrical connection. Is it a terribly well-known thing in America, and am I just an ignoramus? Or did you, again, sort of take what little there is in a historical record and then really sort of interrogate it and then run with it narratively?
I think that it's been interesting to do events in front of British audiences and to think about what I would assume to be common knowledge in America about the Booths and what seems to be common knowledge in the UK about the Booths. And it's not so terribly different. I would say that no one in America does not know that John Wilkes Booth assassinated Abraham Lincoln, and that's not entirely been the case in the UK, but it's mostly been the case. But no, I think the fact, I think that maybe people knew in some way that John Wilkes Booth was an actor, but that's probably the extent of what I would expect an audience in America to know, and the extent of what I knew when I began writing the book.
And particularly with political assassination, there tends to be a narrative which is enforced after that as to motive, how it was carried out. I'm not going to go into Kennedy conspiracy theories here, but I wondered whether, again, that was slightly the case with John Wilkes Booth, and whether part of the appeal with this book is being able to sort of smash some of that American myth-making and to tell a far more nuanced story about the entire family.
I hope so. You know, I, as I began to read about this family, as I began to get interested in the other members, I was sort of caught in a kind of intellectual difficulty, which was, you know, the obvious fact that I would not be writing the book if John Wilkes Booth hadn't assassinated Abraham Lincoln, but also thinking that that John Wilkes Booth was in no way the most interesting person in this family. I don't even put him in the top three. And that, you know, that I had a particular mission to argue that people who don't kill presidents can be just as interesting as people who do. But I, you know, the world of the theater, that was all very new to me, the world of the theater at this period. And that was, you know, where most of the fun for me in the book came in, was learning about what that world was like at that time. But also one of the things that struck me really powerfully, having done this research, was the extent to which I understood the assassination as a performance, that John Wilkes Booth had lines he was going to deliver, that he had blocking he had worked out, that in his head he was giving a theatrical performance. And that, I'd never understood that so clearly.
That's fascinating.
Before.
I never knew that.
Yeah, me neither. But as I said, you know, and you know, one thing didn't go according to plan, that he was going to make this triumphant leap from Lincoln's box onto the stage, deliver his final line, and then make his escape. And someone else in the box managed to grab him by the coat and disrupted the leap so that he broke his leg when he landed on the stage. And possibly he would not have been captured had he not been traveling with a broken leg. Possibly he would have been. No way to know. But again, you know, everything else, clearly he had the timing. You know, there was a moment in the play where there was going to be a big laugh, and he timed the shot so that it would happen during that laugh, so that it wouldn't be heard. I mean, it was just all choreographed very carefully. Mm. And I also think, you know, that growing up in this Shakespearean family, he had this sense of himself as a kind of outsized heroic character in a way that most of us do not grow up thinking of ourselves as, you know, somebody who is going to propel a drama of Shakespearean proportions forward in some way. Right. I was hoping that we would hear from Sophie on the issue of historical research, because I think, as Bridgerton has made extremely clear with the racial casting, which is one of the things that's so interesting, this is not the Regency period. These books take place in a kind of partly historical but partly fantastical setting. And so I'd love to hear how Sophie thought about that. And
oh, massively. And I think that in general, Regency romance, I can't remember if I'm repeating myself, so sorry if I am. I feel like it's in contrast to historical fiction, it's a bit more of a conversation between what actually happened and what we wish happened. And you sort of are in that space. And it was really interesting with Bridgerton. I read a lot around, there's a lot of interesting conversation happening around Bridgerton, where it was sort of like, because they have such a flexible attitude to historical accuracy. And obviously some of that is brilliant and groundbreaking. And I love it. And I love the sort of like racially blind casting. I think that's a fantastic thing. And I love that we're seeing actually that more and more, like with the New Persuasion as well. But then there's also sort of quite a lot of other stuff where they sort of have gone, we don't care about that, which is so interesting, because I think I have to care about it in order to believe in it. So I don't love it myself personally when I'm reading something and I come up against something that I know isn't true, and it breaks me out of the spell. So for me, doing the research, I did want to get as much correct as I possibly could within the realms of not getting, you know, putting my dissertation in, which was a temptation for sure. I did a lot of research, and kind of it was interesting, Jill, saying that you almost wish the journal was a brilliant thing, but also it was a bit of a rod for your own back, because there's some stuff you come across and you're like, I really wish I hadn't learned this, because now I know it, I can't unknow it, and you have to make it work. And you know, once you, I don't think if I know something is true or if I found something out, I can't ignore it. Is how I approach it. But I think it's quite an interesting thing for the whole genre of Regency romance, that you do get more leeway. People aren't expecting you to be as rigidly correct as you are with other things, with other past history.
I think it's, I'm surprised actually to hear how respectful you all seem to be of the historical record. Because I suppose, again, from coming from theatre, where all the time people will take a bit of stuff they've discovered and then they're like, that stuff's not useful, I'm going to make up some stuff that is useful theatrically, otherwise this play's just not going to work. And I know people have played roughshod with all sorts of historical things, but it's really interesting to hear that that you respect the rules, I suppose, of the game, keep what's there. Otherwise, it would feel untrue, or that it would feel, that it wouldn't hit home. Is that right?
It's actually sort of, it is a weird hill to die on sometimes, isn't it? That you have to be accurate, because we are making up, we are sort of professional liars for the most part. So it's strange that you also want that sort of authenticity as well when you're doing something by nature, which is making it up. But it feels really important. And I don't know, I think that the most interesting bits are in the truthful minutiae, where you find out the material a shoe was made out of, and you're like, okay, I guess this is really important to me now. I think it's like in that sort of, the texture, I think, is really hard to get unless you're being accurate. I think people can sense when someone isn't taking it seriously. And even with Regency romance, which is by nature an escapist, frivolous, gorgeously pleasurable genre, I feel like people can tell if the writer doesn't respect their audience. And that's really important to me, that, you know, I personally am writing for very busy women who have 2 hours a week in a very stressful time, in a stressful lives. And just because they want something pleasurable does not make them stupid. So I guess that's where I can...
But also, I mean, we are liars, but the best liars are always believable, aren't they?
Mm. Yes.
The most successful lies are completely believable lies, and it is when they become fantastical that everybody just sees through them at once.
Yeah.
And so I think that is what works with historical fiction. We can't try people's credibility.
Yes.
Yeah.
That is a fantastic sentence to finish on, Jill. I feel like I've tried all of your patience enough with my technical issues this evening. But I can't thank you enough.
The sentence that I am going to take home from Jill is, show me a woman and I'll show you a mystery.
See, there's so many things Jill said that I want tattooed on me. I think it's some great quotes.
Sophie, don't do that. Can I say another thing, which is, don't get anything tattooed on you.
Yeah.
I'm telling you, your mum.
Now, quite often when I'm recording these podcasts, the books are yet to be published, but I'm really pleased to say to anybody who is listening that all of these books are published and available right now. So that is Booth by Karen Joy Fowler, A Lady's Guide to Fortune Hunting by Sophie Irwin, Pandora by Susan Stokes Chapman, and Godmersham Park by Jill Hornby, all out now and available in your local Waterstones or from waterstones.com. There you go, that's my job bit done. Thanks all of you once again for your chat, your conversation, your insight. It's been really, really fantastic. Enjoy the rest of your evening.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Lovely to meet you all.